religion is not my area of academic expertise. Religion and politics is not the area of academic expertise, nor really American political history. Nevertheless, I think it's a really intriguing topic, and I've obviously, if you follow me at all, I've been following the 2012 election cycle quite closely, so I don't mind coming in, not necessarily giving you a long-winded lecture per se, but I'd kind of like to think of this maybe as I'm an honorary free thinker for the day, and I can lead a little bit of a discussion with maybe a little bit more Q&A than you would normally have. So. Again, I really thank Don for some of the suggestions. I think what I'd like to do is just start out not by showing the JFK's religion speech from 1960 in its entirety, but just the first half of it, and then I want to come back and go from there. So if that's okay with you, we're going to start off with that.
I'm grateful for your generous invitation to state my views. While the so-called religious issue is necessarily and properly the chief topic here tonight, I want to emphasize from the outset that I believe that we have far more critical issues in the 1960 campaign. The spread of communist influence until it now festers only 90 miles from the coast of Florida. The humiliating treatment of our president and vice president by those who no longer respect our power, the hungry children I saw in West Virginia, the old people who cannot pay their doctor's bills, the families forced to give up their farms, and America with too many slums, with too few schools, and too late to the moon and outer space. These are the real issues which should decide this campaign, and they are not religious issues. For war and hunger and ignorance and despair, no religious barrier. But because I am a Catholic, and no Catholic has ever been elected president, the real issues in this campaign have been obscured, perhaps deliberately, in some quarters less responsible than this. So it is apparently necessary for me to state once again, not what kind of church I believe in, for that should be important only to me, but what kind of America I believe in. I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no Catholic prelate would tell the president, should he be Catholic, how to act, and no Protestant minister would tell his parishioners for whom to vote, where no church or church school is granted any public funds or political preference, and where no man is denied public office merely because his religion differs from the president who might appoint him or the people who might elect him. I believe in an America that is officially neither Catholic, Protestant, nor Jewish, where no public official either requests or accepts instructions on public policy from the Pope, the National Council of Churches, or any other ecclesiastical source. Where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace or the public acts of its officials, and where religious liberty is so indivisible that an act against one church is treated as an act against all. For while this year it may be a Catholic against whom the finger of suspicion is pointed, in other years it has been and may someday be again a Jew, or a Quaker, or a Unitarian, or a Baptist. It was Virginia's harassment of Baptist preachers, for example, that led to Jefferson's statute of religious freedom. Today I may be the victim, but tomorrow it may be you. Until the whole fabric of our harmonious society is ripped apart at a time of great national peril. Finally, I believe in an America where religious intolerance will someday end, where all men and all churches are treated as equals, where every man has the same right to attend or not to attend the church of his choice, where there is no Catholic vote, no anti-Catholic vote, No block voting of any kind. And where Catholics, Protestants, and Jews, at both the lay and the pastoral levels, will refrain from those attitudes of disdain and division which have so often marred their works in the past and promote instead the American ideal of brotherhood. That is the kind of America in which I believe, and it represents the kind of presidency in which I believe. A great office that must be neither humbled by making it the instrument of any religious group, nor tarnished by arbitrarily withholding it, its occupancy from the members of any one religious group. I believe in a president whose views on religion are his own private affair, neither imposed upon him by the nation, nor imposed by the nation upon him as a condition to holding that office.
One of the more seminal speeches in our nation's history. It is one of the, if not the most, it's the strongest articulation of the logic for the separation of church and state. Interestingly enough, if you ask in the Q&A, I've been doing many a public talk on our constitutional amendments, and we do have an amendment ballot this year that actually deals with the separation of church and state indirectly with respect to funding of religious schools. Anybody has any questions? I don't take positions on those things, but I'll certainly come back and talk to what that amendment's about if need be. So the separation of church and state, and I also think the separation of religion from civic duty or private life from civic duty. And if you look and if you listen to that speech, what he's saying is, you know, we have more, he starts out, we have far more important challenges facing this nation than religion. So let's just park religion. Let's stop talking about religion. Almost, let's compartmentalize it. Religion is a private matter, and these great challenges that are facing our country, he explicitly says, these are not religious issues. And he comes back and says, you know, they affect everybody, and that's why they're not religious issues. And so, and then when he does get back to religion and talking about religious freedom, it's a message of tolerance. And so I think at the time, the broader message to his audience, where there was a little bit of flirtation, can we have a Catholic as a president? Religion as a bit of a litmus test. And his message was, my religious views will not encroach upon my civic responsibilities as president of the United States. My religious views are a private matter, and they will not shape the way that I govern the country. And then there's a second message there, not one where he's telling them how he would view, but one, an expectation that he has from American society, which is religion, it should not be a litmus test. You should not be basing your choice for a president on the religious values of a particular candidate. And again, he goes further to project a message of tolerance and tying this idea of religious freedom to one of tolerance. Fast forward a little over 50 years later, and in this current political cycle, the Republican primary in particular, we had another Northeast Catholic politician, a Catholic politician from the Northeast, Rick Santorum, that seemed to almost shift all the way to the other side of the spectrum. And so, in stark contrast with JFK, Rick Santorum, I would say that, you know, he made his religious views unapologetically shaped his political views, unapologetic about it. And part of who I am and how I'll govern and what I'll do come out of my Catholic faith and my Christian faith. In many ways, he ran on religion. So rather than trying to hide it, he promoted it. I think to his this contributed to his political downfall at a certain point, and I'll come back to that a little bit later. But he had a little bit of a window and opportunity after the Florida primary, where he had a really good night in February, surprisingly pulled off an upset over Romney in Colorado and in Minnesota, and then won in Missouri as well, even though that one didn't count. But he ran up a big victory at that point, had pretty much cornered the market with respect to the conservative vote, and then had 3 weeks before a really crucial primary in Michigan. And at that time, I thought it was very logical for him to pivot now. And I'm more than simply a religious candidate. I have really important sound views on the economy and on national defense. But actually, he spent the next 3 weeks talking about religion still. And he ended up losing in Michigan, and it kind of went downhill from there. Almost more importantly, I don't know if you recall, Santorum listened to the speech of JFK and made a comment about it. Does anybody recall what he said? Yeah, he said it made him sick. I'm not sure if he said, I think he might have said it made him want to vomit. Again, coming back, it was plain and simple, not necessarily all the details, but this idea that we should separate church and state, the idea that the way that you govern should not be shaped by your religious values, for him, that was, it made him sick. And so Kennedy's position made him sick. So for me, the question, and it's not simply Rick Santorum, but the tenor of the 2012 cycle, and in almost the last, I would say, couple of presidential cycles, and in the interim, we've had our two current candidates right now, our current president, Barack Obama, and Mitt Romney, both of themselves have had a little flirtation with disqualification on the basis of religion. In the president's case, more so in 2008, the inaccurate, or sort of the view that secretly he was a Muslim and a Muslim will disqualify you. And then in Romney's case, not so secretly, he's a Mormon and a Mormon shouldn't be president. So both of those candidates have dealt with the religious litmus test issue. Obama, he's dealt with it a little bit differently because it's not so important for him with mainstream voters, but it's simply trying to deal with some of the internet rumors about him being a Muslim. Romney, on the other hand, had something that's known as the Faith in America speech. He gave it in College Station, Texas, of December 2007, when he was running last time, and he certainly cited JFK more favorably, but the speech was rather interesting, and I'll come back to it. He dealt with this question of a religious litmus test a little bit differently. So how did we get from where we were 50 years ago to where we are today? First question, I'll throw it out there to you. Religiosity in America. Do you think that we are a more religious country today than we were 50 years ago? What's your gut sense?
Yes.
No. All right. Well, I went to the Gallup religious identity data set, and they have been doing surveys of Americans since the 1940s. So they have a consistent set of questions, one with respect to Christian identification, percentage of the country that's Christian. They have a question on the personal importance of religion to you in your life. One on church attendance, and then there's a question there that they've been asking for a while, which is, do you think religion is outdated with respect to solving contemporary problems? And so, in part, we might suspect that we've just become more religious over the last 50 years. Relative to other advanced industrialized nations, we are a more religious country, a higher degree of religiosity than our counterparts. But with respect to that trend line in the United States, we're actually a little less religious than we were. It's fairly consistent. Now, with respect to Christian, identification as Christian, right around when JFK's time, or in the 40s, in the 50s, and I think in 1960, it was over 90% of the country identified as some denomination of Christian faith. It's now a little bit under 80%. The trend lines are fairly consistent with all of the other questions, and they gravitate a little bit. So in the net, yes, in the net, we still remain a nation that's more than 3/4 of our population is some form of Christian denomination. a high proportion of folks do think that religion is personally important to them. We attend a church, and most folks think that religion is not outdated, but relative to 50 years ago, all those numbers have dropped about 10%. So it's a little bit less in terms of personally important, a little bit lower church attendance, and more people do think that religious doctrine is outdated with respect to helping to solve problems. So that, for me, is not a very compelling answer, that as a nation, we've just become more religious. So thought through it a little bit more, looked at a little bit more polling, and just tried to think of this question about what's going on in terms of the role of religion in this political cycle and the last few relative to those before. And I think my answer, and I'll just throw it out there, and then I'll come back and I'll walk through what I think are some important developments or milestones historically. My answer is not that religiosity among Americans or specific denominational groups, including I think the conservative Christian movement or the religious right, it's not necessarily that, or not even that religiosity has increased among any particular group or the nation as a whole, but rather the most religious denominations and most religious groups have become much more politically active. So the political activism of those that have a high, you know, that religion is very, very important as part of their cultural identity has increased over time. And then part two of that is the manner in which a number of politicians have strategically reacted to that high degree of activism and organization on the part of, in particular, the Christian coalition, the evangelicals in particular, the most politically activated components of that group. So let me walk through, and I've listed just some of the developments that I think that were important with respect to getting us from where we were when Kennedy made that speech to where we are today in 2012 as we're coming up on the election. With respect to the relationship between Protestants and Catholics in 1960, do you recall any of those of you that were following the election at that time? Do you recall what the relationship was like? It wasn't very good. In fact, Protestants were trying to take Kennedy out. They did not want Kennedy to be elected. So politically, Protestants and Catholics at that time were at odds with one another. And that sort of, a bit of a detente right shortly after the election of Kennedy because of some developments that happened in the 60s. I think Catholics, who comprise a little bit less than 25% of the population here in the country, Protestants still about 50%, about half of those are evangelical. So collectively, we're talking nearly three quarters of the country. But at that big subgroup, the Catholics and Protestants, a bit at odds politically, the most religious, they've sort of merged forces since then, and I'm going to walk through why. What else was going on in the 1960s?
Everything.
What?
Everything.
Everything was going on. What are some of the big civil rights movement? The civil rights movement had, I think the implications of the civil rights movement are rather profound. In particular, the alienation of Southern Democrats. And so that's the part of the roots of political realignment in this country from 1960, what civil rights movement, also what else was happening in the, there was a bit of the Vietnam, there's a bit of a countercultural movement as well as a civil rights movement in the 1960s. And so in particular, you had the sort of the beginnings of a political realignment with respect to Southern Democrats feeling alienated, disaffected, reacting to both the civil rights movement as well as this countercultural movement, which the Democratic Party appeared to be embracing. And so you had a big shift of, again, working class Southerners, white Southerners, that shifted in hordes over the span of a few decades from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. There were problems through the late 60s, and I think Jimmy Carter was the last president because, again, of his professed born-again Christianity that sort of held on to a lot of that vote. But after 1976, it pretty much you had a movement in droves away from the Democratic Party to the Republican Party. And we get to the movements afoot already, but you get to the late 1970s, and this is the time that I think most historians or religious scholars point to the beginnings of the rise of the conservative Christian movement or the religious right movement. Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson begin to become explicitly more politically active. And so I think prior to the late 1970s, much of what religious leaders were doing with respect to, I think they were reinforcing and agreed with that opinion. Kennedy was talking to religious leaders when he was telling them stay out of politics, stay neutral. I think that they were very receptive to that at the time. When you get to the late 1970s and into the 80s, with respect to particularly the evangelicals, it's a different message. It's one of, we need to become more politically active. And some of the common traits or important features of the religious right, the ability to organize with respect to a grassroots perspective, the actual churches, so the physical entities, the organizational apparatus, was very helpful. Not necessarily that every preacher was preaching politics using the bully pulpit, but simply having that network, that those regular meetings, just made it easier to sort of translate and channel politics. If you didn't have to use the bully pulpit on Sunday, many of them did, but that natural organization, that grassroots organization, was certainly helpful. And there's one thing that distinguishes, still to today, evangelical voters from the rest of the country, and I think you know what that is. They turn out. They turn out. They, in terms of a demographic group, certainly seniors turn out. That's one cut with respect to age. But you want to pick a demographic group that just turns out in droves, almost perfect turnout, really high turnout. It's evangelical voters. So high capacity to organize from the grassroots, high proportion of political turnout, they were effective, even though it wasn't a huge block. And many believe that they had an impact in getting Reagan elected in 1980. It was sort of the beginnings of the political influence of the religious right. So we move on through, and this develops through the 1980s. Another thing that I think very, very important was the religious rights or the conservative movement's utilization of communications technology and harnessing it to reinforce some of the natural organizational capacities that they had. With respect, even before we have this communication revolution that really kind of kicks in the 1990s, and we're still in the middle of it, Christian radio, conservative evangelicals really embraced, cornered the market, really used radio and communications technologies to promote an ideological religious message, which again fused politics with religion. Then cable television. Again, they weren't laggards with respect to lining up their own television channels, and so cable television, first radio, and then cable television, and then you get into the age of the internet, which again allows for more effective communications and organizations. Now, not talking about religion, but simply other trends in American politics. One of the ones that I've talked about before, and I do think it underpins a lot of what frustrates people today is a high degree of polarization, which political scientists can measure. We've become a more polarized country. Not necessarily some of the basic questions that have been asked about our views with respect to government and social life and the economy. We really haven't changed the views all that much, but we've just become hyper-attuned to us and them, and we kind of cluster in packages. And so you can see it in the American electorate. You can certainly see it within Congress. But I do think that communications technology, in particular, the internet and 24/7, 365 cable television, have been a part of that. They tend to be echo chambers, so people, more so than interacting with perhaps even a little bit more diverse of a group through their civic organizations. Certainly, it's not that much diversity in some of the religious organizations, but there is some diversity there. When you have that opportunity, to engage with like-minded people through these virtual communities, and it's usually those that are shouting the loudest, the ones with the more extreme views, are the ones that are getting the airtime on television, the ones that are setting up the blog sites. And so I think 1990s, and as we get through into 2000, there's an amplification of religiosity within this particular movement that's fairly adept in terms of their political organization and mobilization. So I think these things were happening, and I think a moment where somebody took a step back and said, huh, and I'm not sure if you're wrong, it was the 2004 exit poll results. This was the Kerry-Bush election. It was a close, contested election. President Bush had high favorability ratings in the immediate wake of the 9/11 attacks and the early stages of the Iraq War. By 2003, 2004, certainly his favorability ratings had come down. There was certainly some angst and pushback, and it was unclear. It was a very close, contested election, but we had the war, the economy was wavering a little bit. And guess what, in the exit polls, in terms of the highest priority issue, got the number one ranking out of about four, the economy, the war. Guess what, I remember it well because I had to go into ABC at 6:30 in the morning the day after the election, just looked at the exit polls. And it was fairly tight, but with a low 30%, guess what voters that turned out in the 2004 election said mattered the most to them? Moral values. It seemed to drop out of the sky. Since then, what people meant when they answered that question is a little bit confounding. I don't think it automatically meant that, evangelicals were running wild. There's a high correlation there. There might have been different segments of the population interpreting moral values and fusing it to something else. But nevertheless, that certainly caught caught the attention of a number of folks, in particular the Democrats. Democrats were not happy. They thought that that they had a shot at taking back the White House at that time. To lose unexpectedly, part of the exit poll mishaps, if you recall, early exit polls actually had shown that Kerry was going to win the election. A lot of the news outlets couldn't hide their smirks as they were reporting, but then when the actual vote totals came in, it turned out that the exit polls were a few percentage points off, and what that means, their turnout models were a little bit wrong, and they didn't account for the selection bias and I guess some of the polling techniques that they use, and would have to correct for that later. But this idea of, well, moral values matters a lot, and there's turnout being pushed. The Democratic Party took a step back at that time, and it reflected on how are they going to deal with that. And what happened, there were a number of consultants on the Democratic Party side that said, you're appearing to be a little bit hostile with respect to people of faith, and people of faith are a huge proportion of the country, and so they suggest certainly toning down the hostility, and to the extent that you are a person of faith, you should display that faith, put it on display. Don't overplay it. You don't want to come across as being sincere, but you want to put it on display. In part, there was a few demographics that they thought that they could that would help with. Again, they were losing a lot of white middle class voters, especially males, that on economic issues should have aligned up with them, and they were losing them in high proportions. Maybe the reason, again, tuning them out culturally, so a little bit more of a display of faith would help. The thought also was that untapped those organizations with respect to in black church communities, if you talked a little bit more about your faith, that would energize them and maybe increase turnout among that demographic group. There was also within not necessarily the evangelical community, but within the broader Christian community, and to a certain extent, a portion of evangelicals, there was a little bit of a theological backlash at that time, because what was happening was there was, again, this conservative ideology, conservative economic ideology was beginning to fuse with some of social conservatism. So you have this fusion of economic conservatism and social conservatism, you know, under the auspices of Christianity. And there were some folks that said, "Hey, wait a minute, Christian doctrine, you know, Jesus Christ, one of the fundamental values, these egalitarian type values are very, very important with respect to taking care of some of the most underprivileged and disadvantaged in a society. And tolerance was a very, very important message of Christ." And here you have the Republican Party that has become highly individualistic, almost anti-egalitarian, and many of the messages that they thought were coming out were not tolerant, were non-tolerant. So you had a bit of a pushback there. Bottom line, though, is that the Democratic Party, beginning 5, 6, 7 years ago, made a conscious effort not to appear anti-religious, toning down almost Kennedy-type messages about separating church and state. And so we get to the 2006 midterm elections. By now, Bush has become increasingly unpopular. The war is unpopular. Economic policy, a lot of folks are not too happy about that. And which demographic do you think? The Democrats doubled down, and they rolled out a number of candidates in swing states and swing districts that were anti-war. They were very critical of Bush economic policies, but they sort of adopted the gods. Guns and or perhaps anti-gay, almost a social conservative agenda or posture. So you had a number of again, Democrats catering a little bit to social conservatives in that 2006 election. Yes?
The same thing as really the rise of the Blue Dog Democrats.
Yes.
And the bigger tent of the Democratic Party that Nancy Pelosi worked on.
Yes.
In 2006, man, I believe.
That's right. And so it's the Blue Dog Democrats. It's a conscious effort in terms of recruitment, but also the memos that's going out almost to the whole party, unless you happen to live in a very, very progressive liberal district, is put your faith on display. Don't tone it down. If you're a person of faith, let people know that that's important and it shapes your values and it's part of who you are. So that mess, it seemed to be successful. Big gains for the Democrats in 2006, and then we get into the 07 and the 08 election cycle. I won't talk too much about the trajectory of the president. I think you follow that fairly closely and are familiar with the accusations that he's secretly a Muslim and he'll have to come out and make a little bit of a showing of his faith. But he never gave, I think, a major speech on faith or religion, unlike Mitt Romney. Faith in America, and in 2007, and it very reminiscent of the context. There's a lot of parallels between the position that Romney was in 2007 and Kennedy back in 1960. So he, in a way, is trying to prevent himself from being disqualified from on the part of evangelicals and the Christian right. And so the speech, I'm not sure if you ever read the transcript. It's interesting. He certainly references Kennedy and in some ways channels some of that. There shouldn't be a litmus test for any particular Christian denomination. But at the same time, it's a very different speech. It's not one that is separating the private from the civic duty, certainly not the separation from church and state. He actually doubling down a little bit on the fusion between libertarian ideology, interestingly enough, and religion. And so he had a line in there that I followed the rest of the transcript, and it's still a little confusing to me, which was he said that freedom, he talked a lot about freedom, religious freedom in that speech. And he said religious freedom is required, liberty requires religion, and religion requires liberty. No, I think he said it the other way. Religion requires liberty. That one's not that hard to understand, or freedom of religion requires liberty. But the second part of it, which was liberty requires religion. And And he connected, he never really got back to that and merely explained himself clearly other than the country was founded on religious values and sort of they infuse everything. And so in a way, liberty is, it connects back or it ties back to some sort of religious foundation. Talked a lot about liberty in that speech. And then in many ways, he talked about his belief in Jesus Christ, compartmentalizing the particulars of the church that he attends, but at the same time reinforcing the religious commonality that he has with the religious right. And so rather than, again, compartmentalizing as Kennedy did, hey, let's not talk about religion, we have more important things to deal with in this country. Mitt Romney, in his 2007 speech, was, well, all of these things are religious issues, but we all have far more in common religiously than the fact that I don't attend the same type of church. I'm a different denomination, let's not worry about that. But my fundamental values are in fact Christian religious values. And again, he reinforces that fusion between religion and politics. He didn't win the primary, and it turned out to be a McCain-Obama election, and Obama gets elected. And then we get to 2009 and 2010. Politically, what jumps to mind in terms of what was the most salient political movement or development in 2010? Obamacare, certainly. What was the reaction to it? The Tea Party, yes. The rise of the Tea Party movement in America, late 2009 into 2010. And you know what that stands for, the acronym, right? It's taxed enough already. So nominally, it's an economic conservative, like a libertarian auspices. Nevertheless, if you've caught any of the Pew Center polls, or there have been a few articles that have bubbled up, the overlap, the correlation between religious conservatives, evangelicals, and Tea Party membership, it's tightly coupled, not perfectly coupled, but rather tightly coupled in terms of simply doing statistical tests, in terms of predicting who will be a Tea Party member, religion is the best predictor. Now, not everybody that has favorable views towards the Tea Party has favorable views towards the religious right. Tends to be 50-50 with a lot of neutral, so it's not 54 and a 50 against, but it's about 50% of Tea Party folks, I think, or not within Tea Party membership, but those that have favorable views of the Tea Party have favorable views of Christian conservatives, and then some neutral views, and then some disagree with them. But if you flip it around, the Christian conservatives, evangelicals or Christian conservatives, have very, very favorable views, almost double the favorability views of the Tea Party. So what that tells me is I don't want to get too far from correlation into causation, but I do think that the libertarian impulse, the anti-Obamacare, sort of the anti-tax, might have been the seedlings or the dawning of that movement, but it was quickly embraced by Christian conservatives. Not necessarily co-opted, potentially co-opted, but quickly embraced by Christian conservatives. They really used a lot of their organizational skills, and then some of the top-down, whether you call it AstroTurf, or the organizational success and the political success of the Tea Party movement. So that those things fused pretty quickly. And if you look at the election results in the 2010 midterms, they were a very influential group. The turnout was low. The turnout in 2010 midterms was very different than the 08 election. It was a much older, it was a much whiter, a much more conservative group of Americans that turned out in the 2010. And it was heavily influenced by the Tea Party. The Tea Party actually took out some of their own in the primaries. And then, well, they certainly put in place an overly conservative candidate once or twice and probably cost themselves a Senate seat in Delaware and a few other places, Nevada, but all things considered, it was a fairly successful event, the 2010 midterm elections, for the Tea Party. Now we get into the 11-12 cycle, and if we look at what happened and how it was a very peculiar Republican primary, But all along, Mitt Romney was the quote-unquote nominal favorite, and which demographic did he have the hardest time pinning down? Yeah, the base, the conservative base, the religious right, the Tea Party, evangelicals. Those were the most distrustful of Romney and really never embraced him. And what they ended up embracing was a parade of potential suitors. Each and every one at one point or another looked more favorable than or were polling higher than Romney. Michelle Bachmann was one of the first, followed by Rick Perry, then Herman Cain, then Newt Gingrich, then Rick Santorum, then Newt Gingrich, then Santorum again, and Romney ultimately survives and the candidates fade away. If you want to harness the support of the Tea Party and that excellent political motivation and you want to win primary elections, what are you going to talk about? Taxes, but I think if you are, unlike Romney, don't necessarily think about Romney. Romney will be talking about taxes the whole time. But for those that wanted to be the darling of the anti-Romney, they needed to lock up support of the Tea Party. They were all jockeying with one another to be there. And you had conscious meetings among evangelical leaders, leaders of the Christian right, understanding that if they split their support among multiple candidates, they're going to lose. Romney's going to win. So they actively got together and caucused and tried to figure out who they would, again, let's work together and try to get somebody other than Romney nominated, because we just don't trust Romney. And if you are a Republican primary candidate, you want to win, you better get those folks lined up behind you. No way around it. So from a strategic political perspective, the high degree of religiosity and the over-the-top religious messaging on the part of some of the Republican candidates, it made perfect sense. It was understandable. Nevertheless, it's not to say that some of the candidates, and I think Rick Santorum in particular, probably believed every single word he said. So I tend to think just watching somebody like Mitt Romney is extremely strategic. So strategic, Massachusetts Mitt showed up at the debate. Did quite well. I don't think the president saw that one coming. So the message tailored very strategically in terms of who do I want, you know, what am I going to do in terms of crafting a message for a particular group. Santorum, I tend to think it was just almost a perfect storm for a candidate like himself to have a revival and almost win. But I don't think that he was forcing messages or tailoring them for political reasons. If he did, he would have pivoted in that critical 3-week period after he had won Minnesota, Missouri, and Colorado. At that time, if he broadened his message, he already had the religious right locked down at that point. But he just kept bringing up abortion and a variety of other social conservative issues that, from a political perspective, it was like you're going, this is going to hurt you really quickly. So I do think he was fairly authentic in terms of his viewpoint, which again is who he is and how he would govern is fundamentally religious, and that's the way that he thinks it should be, and that's the way he thinks the country should be run. He didn't win, and we're back to Romney and Obama, and I don't think either one of the candidates are probably going to make a huge deal of religion in the home stretch here. I think that they certainly will not go out of their way to raise questions about their faith, and so there'll be the occasional little showcase, showing a little leg being, showing a little faith here and there, but it probably won't be a huge issue for the remainder of this election. What happens, where do we go from here? I'm not certain. My crystal ball is a little bit murky. I tend to think the current conditions are here to stay for a little while. The internet's not going away. Evangelicals and the religious right, I don't think that you're going to unpack that fusion right now between social conservatism and that economic conservatism as And there is that anomaly there for me. There's a logical tension sometimes between libertarian messages and, again, some of the teachings of Christianity, which tend to be egalitarian in many ways and not necessarily, or not at all, libertarian. Well, maybe in some ways libertarian. But nevertheless, I think that fusion will be there for a while, and probably for the next couple of cycles, you're going to see candidates, again, trying to increase their viability by courting the religious right, overtly religious messages during political cycles.